and shine, everyone. How's it going out there, chickens and rabbits? And who else have we got? Birds. And we've got, oh, deer and fox. And everyone else who's out there, and children and grown-ups and teenagers and everyone out there listening to Amy's Kids Show. I am so excited to be here today. It's another wonderful, wonderful day on planet Earth, and I'm here, and you're here. This is just such a beautiful place to be, and I'm so glad that you're here with me. I'm really excited this week because we are going to continue reading The Genius Under the Table. This is a book by Eugene Yelchin, and we've been reading this book together for the past 4 shows. Today is number 5. Number 5 out of 6. So I'm going to read almost to the end of the book today. And then next week I'll be back for the grand finale, The Genius Under the Table. And why have we been reading this book for the past, 4 weeks? And why are we going to spend 6 weeks all together reading this amazing book? Well, because it is an amazing book. And in fact, today is a very special day because I'm not going to tell you what's so special about this book. We have the author here to tell you what is so special about this book. Because it turns out that Eugene Yelchin is not just great at drawing pictures. He's an illustrator and an artist. He's also an author. He writes books as well. But as he also is a speaker. He goes around to schools and talks with kids. He talks with kids about growing up behind the Iron Curtain. And he's learned a lot from talking to you guys out there, you children out there. You're so smart, right? And talking to you, I always learn when I'm talking to kids. And well, he learned a lot too. And in fact, the reason why he wrote this book is because a 10-year-old boy suggested it. Actually insisted on it. And then he went around and met more kids and found out that, a lot of kids thought it would be a really good idea for him to write about his childhood so that all the children around the world can understand that we are all so alike, of course, right? We're so alike. We all have so many special talents that we want to explore and grow, right? And we are all growing and learning all the time about the world around us. And we also all want freedom, because freedom is how we can develop our special talents and share them with each other. Well, I am so honored to have a few recordings of interviews with Eugene Yelchin. So those are coming up, and then some reading. And so we only have a time for a couple of songs, so I picked 2 very special songs. Thanks for joining me.
Keeping it safe, lock it up like I always do, 'cause I don't want it to break. But if I keep it to myself, never let the light in, never let it grow. But if I keep it to myself, holding on so tightly, I'm not afraid.
Hi, everyone. My name is Eugene Yelchin, and I'm the author of The Genius Under the Table, published by Candlewick Press. I'm excited to present to you today The Genius Under the Table, a book about growing up behind the Iron Curtain. To be perfectly honest, the idea to write this book was not mine. A 10-year-old boy suggested it to me during one of my school visits. I was speaking to middle grade students about, well, exactly about that, growing up behind the Iron Curtain. And that boy pretty much demanded that I write a book about my childhood. He was fairly adamant on that point. I did not take his idea seriously at first, but with time, I began to notice certain signs which made me think that maybe the boy was onto something. No matter what part of the country I was visiting, most middle grade students had a similar reaction to my childhood stories. I would mention, for example, that I grew up in a communal apartment where all five members of my family had to share a room so small that I had to sleep under the table, and I could see astonishment on my listeners' faces. Or I would tell them that one night I snuck my dad's pencil with me, and while everyone was asleep, I began drawing on the underside of the table, which most likely contributed to me becoming an artist. And again, the listeners seemed to be astonished. And it is exactly that feeling of astonishment, that sudden realization that there is a lot more to life than was earlier suspected, that it is now at the heart of the genius under the table. As a boy, I discovered that there were secrets not only in my family, but in my country as well. The genius under the table dramatizes the discoveries of those secrets, but the secrets themselves are not solved. Not one in my family would share with me anything that could have put me in danger with the KGB. In the former Soviet Union, silence was the means of self-preservation. My questions were left unanswered. Was my grandfather really arrested by the Stalin secret police? Was my mother really forbidden from becoming a ballerina because she was the daughter of a political prisoner? Did my father really believe in communism? Was the KGB informer who lived next door to us was really promoted because he eavesdropped on my parents? The Genius Under the Table is a story about my younger self waking up to the brutal and secretive world. Yet the book turned out to be funny. My childhood described in it is not much different than the childhood of any kid in any country who gradually, one astonishment after another, is beginning to realize that there is a lot more to life than he or she was permitted or capable of seeing. And this gradual realization is exactly what leads to the formation of our identities. It is exactly what gives shape to our subsequent lives. It is exactly what turns us into grown-ups. I hope that you would find a little time to read The Genius Under the Table. It won't take long, I promise. I drew a lot of pictures for this book.
Well, folks, wasn't that really cool? We got to hear from Eugene Yelchin, the author of this book that we're reading, about why he wrote this book. And I just think it's such a beautiful explanation of the story and his life, right? And freedom. And so I want to apologize, though, if I ever get to meet Eugene Yelchin, which I hope I do someday. I would love to talk more with him. I will have to apologize first thing when I meet him, because although I have been doing my best My best is not at all good enough at reading these Russian names. So I have been doing my best there. That has been the hardest part for me of reading this book out loud, have been the Russian names and wanting to say them right. And because I get nervous about saying them right, I always say them wrong. So I want to apologize. That's what nerves will do, right? If we get nervous about something, it's sometimes harder to do it that way. So I do want to apologize. Through this whole story, I have been mispronouncing the protagonist's name. Now, who's the protagonist? Well, the protagonist in a story is the main character. The character everything centers around, the one who usually has some kind of challenge, right, that they have to overcome. It's a story of them overcoming challenges, just like Eugene was just describing. And so the protagonist in this story, I've been calling him Yevgeny because that's how his name is spelled, Y-E-V-G-E-N-Y, Yevgeny. So I've been saying it wrong, though. It's Eugeny. Eugeny, I'm sorry. Eugeny. And I'm still practicing it myself because I just found out how to say it correctly just yesterday. So I'm working on this. I do apologize to Eugene. Eugeny is the main character. And Eugeny lives with his brother Victor, his mom and dad, and his grandma in one room in an apartment in Soviet Russia. And where we left off was, Misha, who is a famous ballet dancer that his mother loves, just defected to the United States. He left. And so because his mother was very sad when we left off about that. And also, though, there was good news for Eugeny. He finds out that he can take some art classes with an artist. His mother has arranged for him to take some art lessons with the woman who makes the sets for the ballets. She makes the paintings that go behind the dancers on the big stages. So she's a famous artist, and Eugeny is going to get to take some art classes with her. And also, his father is also very interested in poetry. We have to remember that part. His father loves Russian poetry. But unfortunately, in Soviet Russia, as in all places in the world where there is censorship, people are not allowed to express their artistic freedom. And any kind of art that does not go along with what the government likes is destroyed. So, or made very difficult to get. So whether that's poetry or paintings or ballets, ballet dances and performances, anything at all, or even just photos of your family, or even just your own papers. And we're going to learn a little bit about that today in the story, how the government collects papers. And to me, it looks like a way of just making sure people don't have, you know, any information laying around. Any history to answer their questions, because we'll also find out questions are not answered in this world of Soviet Russia. All right, chapter 37. Here we go. Mom insisted on escorting me to my first lesson with Tatiana Georgievna. I tried to argue that I should go by myself, but who could argue with Mom? We took a streetcar. The school bag in my lap held a brand new sketchbook, pencils, brushes, and a box of watercolors. My art supplies cost Dad plenty. But as he had never mentioned it to me, I made a secret pledge not to disappoint him this time. Do you know how fortunate you are to be taught by Tatiana Georgievna Bruni? Mom said. The Brunis are the most artistic family in Russia. Painters, musicians, architects. 200 years worth of talent. Are you listening? I was, and so were the rest of the passengers on the streetcar. Mom's voice thundered through the streetcar, describing artistic achievements of every Bruni in great detail. The passengers were listening to her with interest, getting a tour of our city's cultural heritage for the price of a streetcar's ticket. Tatiana Georgievna's great-grandfather, Fidelio Bruni, was of Italian descent, a remarkable painter. His greatest achievement is the Brazen Serpent, on view at the Russian Museum. Do you remember the painting, Eugenie? Oh, yes, I remembered. Fidelio Bruni's greatest achievement was the largest painting I had ever seen, nearly 20 by 30 feet, and also the most horrifying. The painting was very popular with the museum visitors, either because it was so large, or because Bruni chose to paint a story about God punishing Jews for complaining. To teach Jews a lesson, God dropped fiery snakes onto them from the skies. The snakes were so masterfully painted that they had given me nightmares. As Mom kept talking and talking, those nightmares returned. I imagine that Tatiana Georgievna's apartment looked like her great-grandfather's enormous painting, and to teach me a lesson, she was dropping fiery snakes on my head. At home, I had tried to convince Mom to let me go to Tatiana Georgievna by myself, but as we walked up the stairs to her apartment, I became so jittery that I asked her to come in with me. But no matter how much I begged her, Mom refused to be in the way of a meeting of two artistic talents. She gave me a quick hug and dashed downstairs. I waited until the front door slammed down below, took a deep breath, and pressed the buzzer beside the brass plate engraved in cursive, T.G. Bruni. Tatiana Georgievna opened the door. "Come in, dear. I was expecting you." Her apartment was roomy and bright. No snakes anywhere. Pretending that you had just had a big meal when offered something to eat was a sign of good manners, according to my mother, and that was why I firmly refused tea and chocolate eclairs. Tatiana Georgievna dismissed my refusal as nonsense, luckily, and went to the kitchen to put on the kettle. Clutching the school bag with the art supplies to my chest, I tiptoed around the room where I was to be shown the ropes. The walls were hung with the framed paintings, each signed T. Bruni in the lower right corner. The paintings were not as large as Fidelio Bruni's, yet they were no less weird. I had been to every Leningrad museum by then, but I had never seen anything like this before. The people in those paintings must have been ballet dancers. But instead of tights and tutus, they wore costumes that looked like machines, work tools, and battleships. Their geometric shapes and eye-popping colors burst out of the frames and made me dizzy. "What do you think of those, Eugenie?" Tatiana Georgievna walked in with a steaming teapot, cups, and a plate of plump chocolate eclairs on a tray. "The pictures are for a ballet called The Bolt. Dima Shostakovich composed the score. A crazy ballet with a crazy title. But we were all crazy then, young and naive. We believed anything was possible." She sat the tray beside her easel. "We were allowed one performance only. Somebody at the top ordered the critics to hate it, and the ballet was closed. Luckily, no one was arrested." "Who was it? Who ordered the critics to hate it?" I asked. "Try the eclairs, Eugenie. They're delicious." I looked at the pictures again. arresting someone for putting on a ballet sounded like one of Stalin's mistakes. I wanted to ask Tatiana Georgievna to explain, but I didn't dare. Chapter 38. Tatiana Georgievna had lots of wonderful books in her apartment. The books were about Russian artists, but they were printed in foreign languages. I had neither heard the artists' names nor seen their art in the local museums. The books had been given to Tatiana Georgievna as gifts from talented dancers, choreographers, and musicians who brought them while touring abroad. I spent hours in her apartment painting copies of strange and beautiful pictures I discovered in those books. I worked silently, not wanting to disturb Tatiana Georgievna at her easel, but each book I pulled off the shelf made her stop painting and look over my shoulder. "Ah, Marc Chagall, what marvelous colors! A Jewish magician. Born in Russia, went to France, came back after the revolution to help our young country. But when the Communist Party took over the arts, Chagall left Russia again. Still in France, by the way. Still paints beautiful paintings." I copied Chagall's goats, roosters, and green-faced Jews floating across cobalt skies, as if our Soviet force of gravity had no chance to hold them down. When I opened another book, Tatiana Georgievna said, "Kandinsky? Some claim that he invented abstract painting. Personally, I'm not convinced. I think Malevich did it. Malevich stayed in Russia and was banned from painting what he wanted. But Kandinsky went to Germany and kept making his gorgeous abstractions." I copied Kandinsky and Malevich. I had a huge stack of paintings by now, but they were so bad that even Chagall, Kandinsky, or Malevich would not have recognized their originals in my copies. Tatiana Georgievna did not seem to be bothered by my tilted and muddy pictures. She smiled, praised my efforts, and explained techniques for bringing my copies closer to what the artists had in mind. At home, I was making my own pictures. They were nowhere near as good as anything I had found in Tatiana Georgievna's books, but I kept working, drawing, and painting instead of doing homework. Soon, I was way behind in school. I hid my terrible grades from Mom and Dad, but they did not seem to care. They did not seem to care to know. As long as I was practicing my artistic talent, my parents were perfectly content. Chapter 39. I wonder if there were two kinds of Russian artists, I said to Tatiana Georgievna after I went through all her books. Those who defect from Russia and those who stay home. Tatiana Georgievna smiled at me from behind her easel. The defectors kept making the art they wanted to make, I said. But those who stayed behind were not allowed to do that. Their art was banned. Some were arrested. Some were even shot to death. Tatiana Georgievna kept painting, but she stopped smiling. But I think there's also the third kind, I said. Those who neither defected nor were arrested or killed. Tatiana Georgievna glanced at me. Why were they spared, Eugenie? I don't know. Take, for example, my old art teacher, Zinaida Ivanovna. It was in her fifth or sixth grade, I think. She wanted us to draw a cube. She had one very ugly cube sitting on her desk. She drew the cube herself on the blackboard first and then had everyone copy her picture instead of drawing the cube itself. You know what Zenaida Ivanovna used to call it? Drawing by the rules. Tatiana Georgievna laughed. Did you draw by her rules, Eugenie? I wish I could. If I could follow her rules, I'd never get in trouble. I thought about it for a minute. So those artists who stayed behind, those artists who were spared, they were spared because they figured out how to make art by the rules. That's what I think, I said. Tatiana Georgievna continued painting in silence. Her brush barely touched the paper, leaving feathery strokes of soft and silky glow. Her painting was beautiful, but the only thing it had in common with the paintings for the band ballet The Bolt, framed on the walls, was her signature in the lower right corner. Over 40 years had passed since she had painted those pictures on the walls, but they were still vibrating under the glass as if they were alive. I could feel none of that vibration under Tatiana Georgievna's brush now. I should have never said what I said about the artists who were spared by the government. The last thing I wanted was to make Tatiana Georgievna upset. It was not her fault that she was born a celebrated Bruni. If she had defected to some foreign country, she would have felt terribly guilty for breaking the 200-year tradition of artistic talent in Russia. Had she stayed home and kept on painting her weird designs, she would have been arrested and possibly killed. Instead, Tatiana Georgievna chose to follow the rules. It was probably a good decision, but the price she had to pay for it was high. She had to settle for making pretty pictures instead of making great ones. I'll change the water for you, Tatiana Georgievna. I grabbed the water glass in which she rinsed her watercolor brushes and bolted for the kitchen before she saw me blush. Chapter 40. Then the winter came and went with another winter. I'm sorry, let me start this again. Chapter 40. Then the winter came and went, and then another winter came. It was dark by 4 in the afternoon. By the time I would return home from Tatiana Georgievna's apartment, our street was pitch black. Once, someone jumped out at me from under our courtyard's archway. I spun around and started running, but the man, it was a man, caught me by the shoulder and spun me around. Dad, what the heck are you doing? Did I scare you? Sorry, my dear, sorry. I was waiting for you. He threw his arm over my shoulders, pulled me in tight, and began walking away from our house. Were you at Tatiana Georgievna's, making great art together? I'm so proud of your talent, Eugenie, so proud. I could tell he was excited about something because he was walking incredibly fast. He sort of dragged me along at a trot. Where are we going, Dad? Oh, just a walk, Eugenie, just a brief, vigorous walk, good for your heart, in such excellent weather. He drew a deep breath and exhaled a cloud of steam. It was about 15 below. You'd be interested to know, Eugenie, that our state literary house has just released a book of poems by... Dad, you have lots of books of poems already. What do you need? No. You don't understand, Eugenie. A book of poems by Osip Mandelstam, the great, great, great Russian poet. Dad leaped up a little from excitement, slipped over an icy patch, and fell, pulling me down with him. We sat in a snowdrift with our feet sticking out like stick figures I used to draw as a kid. I looked at my dad laughing, and after a while, I was laughing too. I was still laughing when he whispered into my ear, "But there's a catch, Eugenie. We need a coupon. I'm counting on you." Now, I knew what that was all about. Twice a year, Soviet school children were required to collect recyclable paper waste. Some big shot in Moscow assigned the amount of poundage school districts were supposed to collect. Come what may, each district had to deliver the pounds. The collecting was organized as a socialist competition between the grades. We were split into teams and marched door to door to pester citizens for old newspapers, magazines, letters, packages, and anything else made of paper that could be recycled. School children didn't get anything in return for their labors, but if you were a grown-up and decided to join in, 22 pounds of collected paper would earn you a special coupon. You got that coupon stamped at the collecting stations where your paper waste was weighed. Like everything else in Russia, books, especially good books, were in short supply. As a reward for paper collecting, they let you exchange your stamped coupon for some great book that you could never buy in a regular bookstore. Dad had gotten lots of his poetry books with coupons. Victor and I earned them for him. "Do you think it's easy to round up 22 pounds of paper, Dad? You try it." Dad was too embarrassed to even look in my direction. "Why can't you do it yourself, Dad? Other grown-ups do it. My friend Serega's dad, for example, he also wanted some book he could only get with a stamped coupon. He's a communist like you, Dad. A big cheese somewhere, ahead of some factory or something. He's got no time for begging door to door. He asked Serega to help, but Serega said, 'Forget it, Dad. You want the book? You collect the paper yourself.' So guess what his father did to save his valuable time? Guess, Dad, guess." He smiled, watching me laugh. "What did he do, Eugenie?" "He went to the House of Books on Nevsky and bought up 3 sets of complete works of Lenin. Lenin wrote a lot of stuff, Dad. Did you know that? 57 volumes in each set. Multiply that by 3. I looked at Dad for help.
171.
171 books, Dad. Imagine how heavy they were. More pounds than he needed. Smart, right? But when he took the books to the exchange station to swap his Lenins for stamps, they called the KGB on him. Serega and his dad were in hot water for that one. They kicked him out of the Communist Party, took his fancy job away, and now he's a janitor or something. Isn't that funny, Dad?" Had I not laughed so hard, I would have noticed that my father's kind, smiley face had become his tight-lipped communist face again. He scrambled out of the snowdrift, glared at me with disgust, and stormed away. "Wait, Dad!" I shouted after him. "I'm sorry about Lenin. I'll get you that coupon. I promise." Chapter 41. Dad was too proud to mention the coupon again, but he could barely look at me. Yes or no? That was how far his conversations with me went. Once again, I had disappointed my father. He did not care that I still had to collect paper for school, attend classes, take lessons with Tatiana Georgievna, and make my own pictures. All he cared about was that fellow Mandelstam. If we had studied Mandelstam's poems in our Russian literature classes, I might have been more enthusiastic about Dad's request. But the only thing I knew about him was what Dad told me once on the way to the public bathhouse. That he had said, "Poetry is so respected in Russia that poets are killed for it. Why would poets be killed if poetry were so respected? At first, it did not make any sense to me, but after studying Tatiana Georgievna's art books, I began to understand what Mandelstam might have been talking about. Poets were artists, too. If they did not make art by the rules, they were in trouble in our country. I did not know if Mandelstam was killed for his poetry, but asking Dad about it was useless. He would have never told me the truth anyhow. Still, I had to collect 22 pounds of paper. Whatever it took, I could not disappoint Dad again. The idea to turn to crime came to me when I noticed that our schoolyard was overflowing with paper. The waste was supposed to have been weighed and trucked off long ago, but for some important government reason, no trucks were available. We were told to continue with our socialist competition. While we unloaded paper waste off our sleds, a loudspeaker in the schoolyard droned, "The USSR has climbed a mountain from where we can see our final goal, a thriving communist society." And a mountain it was. Thousands of pounds of paper were slowly rotting in our schoolyard. Daily after our classes ended, I joined my team on collecting expeditions, hauled what I gathered back to the schoolyard, and dumped my share at the foot of the mountain. In the evenings, I returned to steal the paper. Chapter 42. One night when I came back to the schoolyard, a girl I had never seen before sat atop the mountain of waste. Wet chunks of snow fell from the skies, hitting the rotting paper like snowballs, but she did not seem to care. She was hunched over something that looked like a book. I piled my sled with stolen paper in a hurry. The collection station was about to close, and the school's custodian could still be prowling the grounds. I almost left. Instead, I climbed the mountain to see what she was reading. "Get out of here," she greeted me. "I thought you were reading a book, but it's just a photo album." "Oh, please," she slammed the album shut. "A real genius." "Genius under the table." "What?" "Nothing, it's stupid. That's what my dad called me once." She squinted at me for a moment, then turned away and opened the album again. "Leave me alone, all right?" I leaned over her shoulder to look at the photos. It was a family photo album, nothing unusual. Black and white pictures glued to the black pages, like in everyone else's album. Except that someone's face had been snipped out with scissors from every picture. "That's so weird," I said. "My grandma's photo album is exactly like that. In the photos with my grandma and my mom, some other fellow was cut out. I don't even know who that fellow was." The girl turned and looked up at me with interest. "Was your grandfather arrested?" "Why would my grandfather be arrested?" I said. "There would be no other reason they cut him out, would there?" Nobody had ever told me anything about my grandfather, except after the ballet audition, when Mom said that Vaganova could not accept her to the ballet academy because of her father. "When the state security arrested people," the girl said, "their relatives cut them out of their family pictures." She opened and closed two fingers as if snipping someone out of a picture with scissors. "Why?" I asked. "So they wouldn't be accused of any relationship to enemies of the people." "What does that mean, enemies of the people?" I asked. Could you not be such an idiot, please? That's what they called those who were arrested, enemies of the people. I had never heard such a thing before. Was my grandfather an enemy of the people? My granddad was arrested in 1953, the girl said. He was a doctor, but he was tried as an agent of international Zionism. They were arresting Jewish doctors then. My family never saw him again. The man with the tattoo in the bathhouse had said something about Jewish doctors, how they had poisoned Stalin. Was your grandfather Jewish? I said. You're not listening. In 1953, they were arresting and shooting Jews. They were beaten in the streets all over the country. Stalin was going to round up all the Jews, put them in cattle cars, and send them off to Siberia to die, but he messed up, the butcher. He couldn't pull it off. Why not? Stalin died that year? She turned away from me and looked at the album again. The wet snow kept falling, whacking the rotten mountain. I tried to imagine my family in a cattle car going to Siberia. Then I tried not to, but I could not get the picture out of my head. Why did Stalin want to do that, send Jews to Siberia? The girl shrugged. My mom thinks it was a provocation. The Americans would have gotten mad at us, and Stalin could have used it to start another war. Against the Americans? But that would be a nuclear war. Then we would all be... Someone was climbing up the mountain toward us. What the hell are you still doing here? The man shouted. I recognized Serega's father, the communist big cheese turned custodian for trying to swap Lenin's books for stamped coupons. He snatched the photo album out of the girl's hands and flung it aside. Get out of here before I call the cops. All right, folks. Well, that's where we're going to end the story for today, all right? So Eugenie is collecting papers and piling them in a big pile to rot, right? So were the people left with any newspapers or letters or even photo albums or books in their homes? Probably not after having all these kids come year after year begging for them, right? Begging for their 22 pounds so that they could meet their quota and so their dads could get their coupons, apparently for poetry in Eugenie's case. Thanks for joining me. We're going to hear from the author himself again. Here's Eugene Yelchin describing his books.
Hello, my name is Eugene Yelchin. I'm an author and illustrator of books for young readers. Frankly, I find illustrating easier than writing, mainly because I've been making art a lot longer. I began drawing pictures when I was little, but I did not write my first middle grade novel until I was old. The reason for such a late start is this. I didn't know how to speak English, let alone know how to write in it, until I was in my mid-30s. I had been speaking and writing in Russian until then. Russia, when I still lived there, was called the USSR, or the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. If you think the name was long, take a look at an old map. 1/6 of the world was painted red just to make the name fit. But no matter how vast were our borders, they were so perfectly guarded that nobody could sneak in. Nobody could sneak out either. But I managed to do just that. When I was 27 years old, I immigrated to the United States. In Russia, I had always wanted to become an American, and I had often pretended to be one with my friends. I listened to American music, watched old American movies, and dressed in fake homemade American clothes. But when I finally found myself in the US, I realized that I imagined America all wrong. I didn't know how to become a real American, and I had no clue what to do with my new unalienable rights. Life liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I had my life, I had my liberty, but to pursue happiness was such a foreign concept that I began to suspect that in order for me to become an American, I had to stop being Soviet first. The transition from a Soviet to an American was an immense undertaking, and it took many years. Did I succeed? Not entirely, but one terrific thing did happen. In order to make sense of what held me back, I began writing about my past. It occurred to me that my struggle to change and to grow was a story in which I was a protagonist. Besides, I was in the possession of information about the USSR and the experience of living behind the Iron Curtain that was not well known and could be useful to the young American readers. I didn't need to invent very much to write myself into a story. In my real, everyday life, I had to accomplish a difficult task that every classic story protagonist must accomplish. I knew what I wanted, I had a strong goal, but somehow I had to change myself from within in order to achieve it. Studying classic literature was a great help. I began to notice that in well-told stories, the protagonist's transformation is inevitable and yet somehow surprising. In order to succeed, a protagonist has to find courage to leave behind what was familiar once and comforting but no longer useful, even harmful, since it prevented protagonist from achieving the goal, which was exactly what I had to do in my new American life. Here are two of my books in which I used myself to create the protagonists. My first book, Breaking Stalin's Nose, and my last one, Genius Under the Table. In Breaking Stalin's Nose, a version of my younger self is a protagonist in a story set in the USSR under the rule of a ruthless dictator, Joseph Stalin. The protagonist's name is Sasha Zaychik. Sasha wants to be a hero and a communist like his father and like his idol, Comrade Stalin. When his father is arrested on Stalin's orders, Sasha slowly realizes that in order to become a communist, he must sacrifice his moral values, his integrity, and his sense of justice. In Genius Under the Table, the protagonist is me, Evgeny Yelchin. Evgeny wants to become a great artist, but he lacks courage. He fearfully navigates the complicated world of his family, a communal apartment in which his family lives in one small room, art classes at school, and by extension, the entire world of his country. A country in which fear is shared by all, in which silence is the means of self-preservation, in which everyday life is unthinkable without lying. Evgeny's growing sense of disillusionment with his parents and with his country is complicated by his intense love for his family and his home. Breaking Stalin's Nose is a work of fiction, while Genius Under the Table is a memoir, a work of nonfiction. Yet the boundaries between what is fiction and what is nonfiction are blurred in these books. Fiction is written as a nonfictional account of real events, while nonfiction strives for dramatic or comedic effects. The protagonists of these two books are versions of myself, one imagined and one real. But the boundary between those two selves, real and imagined, is as blurred as a boundary between fiction and nonfiction genres. Both stories suggest a possible success, but they do not describe it. Both stories are left open-ended. Will my protagonists ever succeed? Will I? Perhaps it's not all that important. To quote Anton Chekhov, a 19th century Russian short stories writer and a playwright, the role of the artist is to ask questions, not to answer them. I began writing because I had a lot of questions about myself and because I did not know how to answer them. I needed to understand my past in order to make sense of my present and make plans for my future. Breaking Stalin's Nose and Genius Under the Table are my personal narratives, written about two young boys slowly and painfully and often in spite of themselves moving from the oppression toward liberation, toward freedom. In the end, my books, not unlike my real life, turn out to be about freedom and about the unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By writing these books, I was helping myself. But my hope is that in looking through the eyes of Sasha Zaychuk and Yevgeny Yelchin, the young readers might view their unalienable rights in a slightly different light. They might become more attentive to what they inherited. They might consider that preserving those rights requires personal courage. They might not take the pursuit of happiness lightly. That in fact, as my protagonists show, happiness is sometimes only achieved at great risk of both life and liberty.
Time you cannot get to sleep. Reading is the answer. Why bother counting sheep? Read a book.
That's good advice, right? Read a book? Well, that's what we've been doing here on Amy's Kids Show for the past, well, now it's been 5 episodes, and next week will be the final episode for the exciting conclusion of The Genius Under the Table by Eugene Yelchin. We have been reading this book by Eugene, and it's been just such an honor and a pleasure to share this amazing story with you about growing up behind the Iron Curtain in Soviet Russia. And I really feel like we have a lot in common with Eugene these days. I mean, It's kind of weird, but our countries, our governments, the United States of America and Russia, are going to war again. There seems to be a big war between our governments. But the weird part is, like, they're acting more alike as governments than different. As the USSR has become more like the United States has become more like the USSR. I never thought that my country of freedom would be a place where we would feel silenced and scared to talk about things, to ask questions, you know, even feel like we have to lie to get through the day. More and more people are feeling that way, afraid to speak up, afraid to tell the truth. Boy, guys, you know, we've got to crack this problem, because the people of the USSR, the people of Russia today, and the people of the United States, we are so alike. I mean, that's one thing the story really tells me, is how much alike the people are, right? And so if we, the people, can all just get together, maybe we can, you know, stop our governments from being so silly and mean, and get together, right? Because we all do love freedom, and we want to read the poetry that people are writing, and we want to see the paintings that people are painting, and we want to see the ballets, and we want to hear from you guys, the children, right? We want you to grow up in a world where you are free to say what you want and ask questions and explore and definitely be yourself and explore all of your talents, because I know that you have so many, right? But we have to be free. We can't be afraid. And we certainly can't silence each other or destroy books or destroy paintings, like they gathered all those papers in the part of the story that we read today, and just let them rot. All those amazing newspapers and things. Well, that is happening today, right, folks? There are things on the internet that are taken down by our government and by different officials and different companies and things. So we can do something about that, right? We can save those things. And I noticed in those interviews with Eugene Yeltsin, you didn't get to see them, but behind him, it looks like it's in his house. He has tons of paintings and books and things that he's collecting. What are you going to collect? What parts of freedom are you going to help us save? Huh? Well, it's up to all of us, guys, to chip in and help each other out here on planet Earth. Thanks for joining me for Amy's Kids Show. Have a wonderful week.
I've been hiding my heart from you, thinking of keeping it safe. Lock it up like I always do.